Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
You are listening to Habsent Minded, brought to you by HabsEyesOnThePrize.com. BetOnline continues to be your number one source for all your basketball wagering needs, including pro and college hoops throughout the year. With up-to-the-minute odds, stats, and trends, you can follow your favorite team's path to the playoffs with in-game live betting, contests, and all the best player props. Experience the world's best wagering platform anytime from your desktop or your mobile devices. Head to BetOnline today to become part of the team and remember to use promo code BELIEVE, that's B-L-E-A-V, for your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. BetOnline, the game starts here.
Hello and welcome to this unnamed...
Still don't have a title.
Yeah, this unnamed women's hockey podcast. I was gonna start my regular intro for our Canadian podcast, and I'm like, no, that's not what we're doing here. My name is Jared Book. You heard Zoe Hayden's voice, editor at Victory Press. Zoe, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, we still don't have a name for this. You know, it's the theme of the PWHL, right? We'll come up with names.
Yeah,
we're ready
for it.
We
don't need a name.
Yeah,
we don't need a name to be successful. I think that's a very good point.
Yeah, you know, for season two, maybe we'll have a name. We'll see.
Yeah,
we don't have somebody like Amy Shear working for us and coming up with these names, but when it's ready, we will announce it. Speaking of announcing, we have our first trade in the PWHL, and I'm going to go on a limb, and I'm pretty sure it's not really a limb, but I think this is the first hockey trade that we've ever seen in women's hockey, where it's not because somebody wanted to play somewhere else. It's not because, it's not for future considerations. It's a real hockey trade where two teams are trying to get better themselves. And if you didn't see it, it was Minnesota trading Abby Cook and Susanna Tappany to Boston for Sophie Jakes. And Zoe, your first thoughts when you saw that trade?
First of all, it happened like right at the beginning of the Super Bowl, which I wasn't watching, but I was
literally
I was taking the opportunity to like run some errands, you know, with public basically being deserted at the time. So I saw it on my phone and I was like, that's interesting. And it made complete sense to me at the time because I really was sensing that Sophie Jakes wasn't fitting in Boston where they probably wanted her to fit in. You know, she hadn't really been utilized very much. I did see her making some like kind of strong individual offensive efforts, but I didn't see her really contributing to like their all around game the way that some of their other defenders have been doing. And I think they're defense corps in general has been pretty good at like kind of generating things and having like the right instincts from the offensive blue line. And you know, that's kind of where Sophie Jakes is supposed to shine, right? Is being like inside that offensive blue line and going to work. But she really wasn't getting the opportunities, I think, to make the kind of plays that she might instinctually want to make based on her history. I think just because Boston's style is very different than what she's been playing at Ohio State for the last 5 years. And I think the adjustment period just maybe wasn't something that she and the staff were kind of like mutually, you know, on the same page about. Like, you know, not to say that she was playing badly, but I think, you know, they signed her to a 3-year contract. They're probably thinking, like, you know, what's the next step here? How do we move on from this where, you know, maybe you're not playing the way that you want to play and where we're not getting necessarily what we need to get out of our, say, 7 defenders that we dress every night. So it made sense to me specifically from the Sophie Jakes perspective. And I'm not 100% sure who originated the trade, but I kind of get the sense that maybe Boston may have been shopping her to see, like, you know, what they might be able to get in return that would fit into what they're trying to do. And I think it makes sense that maybe she was also open to going somewhere else potentially. And I really liked what Natalie Darwitz had to say about her as a player. I think in the quotes that Haley Salvian published at The Athletic, just about how, like, you know, they're gonna try to put her in a position where she can really like be let loose and go thrive. And I think that is a great move from a purely Sophie Jakes perspective.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me because I don't watch as much NCAA hockey as I want to. A because it's not always available without going through internet hoops in Canada. And B just because there's only so much hockey one can consume at one time, and you have to make choices of what hockey you watch and what you don't watch. But obviously you hear about the season she had in her senior year, the Patty Kazmaier, and things like that. And heading into the draft, she's someone that people looked at as a potential first round pick. She ended up going middle-ish of round two, and it seems like she does take like. Throughout her career, like you look at her numbers from her freshman and sophomore years, like they don't leap off the page like her junior and senior seasons do. And I think that you even saw it in the start of the rivalry series when she got the call for Canada. She just didn't seem like she was at that level yet. And I think that what you see is that you see a team like Boston, and they put her with Emily Brown to start the year. She was on a pairing with Megan Keller a little bit. There was DiGirolamo as well, who was on that left side with her. And so I feel like they are in a point where they aren't necessarily in a position where they can afford to wait because it's a very veteran heavy team, and I think that they want their defense to kind of defer to the forwards because they have so much talent at forward, and she wasn't necessarily able to do that and play the game that makes her best. And I think that it's gonna be interesting to see the fit in Minnesota because Minnesota is a team that has really driven play through their forwards driving through the ice, like Grace Zumwinkel, Taylor Heise, like those are players that have, even Kendall Coyne Schofield, like players that rush the puck, and it'll be interesting to add a defender to that group, and see what she can do, offensively, and also give her the time to develop. And there's also kind of long-term salary implications as well, right? Because you mentioned a 3-year contract, that does come with a salary of at least $80,000, that's mandated. And when you have a salary cap. And you have a player that you can't necessarily trust to be in your top six. And at the end of, her time in Boston, she was often listed as a seventh defender. You can't necessarily afford to do that in a cap sense either, right? So it, very interesting to see
And
to see this trade.
Those 3-year contracts are also like the multi-year contracts. They can't be dismissed for performance reasons. Those are guaranteed. So, you know, if they had signed Sophie Jakes to a 1-year contract, we might be having a very different conversation, but they didn't. They signed her to a 3-year, like one of those, like, you know, keystone contracts that they're required to maintain. So if it wasn't working out for them and they didn't really want to, I hesitate to say it this way because it makes it sound kind of mean. And I don't think that they have any mean feelings about Sophie Jakes or her play at all. But it's like, if they're saying like, you know, you're going to need more time to settle in at this level, and we're not sure that this is the best place for you to do that, like, it makes sense. I do think, like, you know, the way that teams forecheck in this league is something that Shirley hasn't had to deal with before. Like, you know, even in the WCHA, which is a much more contact heavy conference, like the physical level of forechecking that you're getting in the PWHL is still so well beyond that. And I think that it's kind of like, it has the potential to really mess with her pacing and her, you know, her instincts and timing in a way that's going to take, you know, a little bit of time for her to settle in.
Yeah. And it's, she's really also like the first like high profile rookie that we've seen enter, you know, really, you know, at a high level league. Even, you know, if you look at the CWHL, PHF, usually those top rookies have the national team experience, like a Taylor Heise, like a Alina Mueller. They don't necessarily have like actual development to do. Like, she's really the first that I could think of, and there might be others that I'm not thinking of, but she's really the first top prospect that has come in and had high expectations, but hasn't had that experience at the senior national team. And when you enter a league like this, it's a different pace. And that's not taking anything away from her. It's just a reality of the situation. You ask any of the players coming from the NCAA, and they'll say that the pace is different. Even if you ask a Taylor Heise or an Alina Mueller, who have that national team experience, they'll say, yeah, it's a different style of play. And I think that there's never really been, and I don't have the list in front of me, but I can't remember a Patty Kazmaier or a winner that has just had to kind of come in with that high expectation, especially as a defender. And you know, typically they develop later anyway. It takes more time, and just have that struggle. And she's not the first one. I mean, someone else who has that same style of play is someone like Erin Ambrose, and it took her a few years to kind of hit her stride as well. And it's not, nothing I'm saying is that she's not going to get there. It's just when you're in a cap league and you commit to a player like that, you know. And it's clear that, you know, I think it's clear by this trade that she wasn't fitting into their plans. And that's nothing against her. It's just teams have different realities, that it's best just to move on and see what happens. And it's, I'm sure that there were other teams that have maybe, that maybe inquired, but maybe didn't have the, didn't want to give up a forward piece like a Tapani, that Minnesota did. And it's going to be very interesting to see how, I mean, that forward group just gets even stronger, right? It's an embarrassment of riches at this point. Of what they can do offensively there in Boston.
Yeah. I feel like, I don't know. I feel like I'm having this debate with myself because people keep saying like, oh yeah, their forward group is so strong. Like, you know, someone mentioned to me the other day that like they lead the league in like shooting percentage, like team shooting percentage. But a lot of that comes from Mueller, because wasn't Mueller shooting at like 50% for a while?
Gable as well had that game, the hat trick game.
Like, I think that number is like a bit, you know, misleading. To me, their offense has looked the least cohesive. Like, I mean, you say what you will about Toronto, but, you know, and Spooner really carrying them right now, but Spooner got hot, and it's not like the players around her aren't also getting chances. She just happens to be the one finishing. Like, they look like a different team since that shootout win that they got.
Yes.
Like across the board. And to me, Boston's forwards are really the, it's the group that to me hasn't clicked yet, that really haven't like kind of shown what their style and their identity is going to be. Like they're not finishing, I think, at the level that they really need to be finishing at, which is exactly what we were saying about Toronto a few weeks ago. And I think like the addition that they get with Tapani into this group is a really great return for them. And I think that Abby Cook is also an awesome option for them, who really might fit more into what their current defender group is. Like they need someone reliable who can really like kind of hit the net consistently to generate rebounds, who can carry the puck super well and who has a bit of size, I think. And I think Abby Cook really covers all of those bases for them. I think it's a great return for Boston. Like people, a lot of people have said like, you know, Minnesota obviously won this trade, and I don't know if that's necessarily true. I think that to me, looking at both rosters, I think it addresses kind of the same level of need for both teams in a way. I think it's a good trade for both parties.
Yeah, you mentioned Abby Cook, and she kind of fits into, I want to say, that whole kind of Minnesota team identity, where they don't have like the, other than like the Zumwinkles, the Heisies, like they don't have like that player that's going to like have that name recognition, but they're just a solid team. And mm-hmm. she really fits into that. Like there's a lot of players on that team that, you know, if you don't follow Minnesota women's hockey, you know, you might not know who they are. But they're just all really good players. And yeah, I think that, you know, she can kind of fit into that Boston team and kind of solidify that, them defensively, and kind of start to play up ice and you know, give the puck to the Hillary Knights and the Elite Mueller's and have them kind of rush it up. And yeah, it'll be very interesting to see, because yeah, it's they're a team, but Boston and Toronto, I think, are the two teams that people, and I guess you can lump New York into that as well, people that thought that they would be much better than they've performed. And that's not to say that Boston's mm-hmm. performed badly. They're still, you know, I think they're third in the league at this point. But it's just, you look at that roster and you're like, okay, when's it going to come? Like, when, and they've had spurts of it, but then they, you know, they had that top line of Knight, Mueller, and Gable, and then they broke that line up against Montreal and, mm-hmm. and, you know, were relatively outplayed in that game.
Yeah, I've seen several games from them where I feel like their fourth line was actually their best line. Like, mm-hmm. you know, Gigi Marvin just like directing like all kinds of crazy stuff from the neutral zone, like getting these great passes, cycling in the offensive zone as well. Like, and you love to have a fourth line like that, but you really want to see more of that energy from your top six.
Like, no offense to like Taylor Gerrard and Gigi Marvin and Amanda Pelkey, but like, if they're your best mm-hmm. forwards, something's gone wrong, right? With, mm-hmm. with that roster. And yeah, I mean, even the first game, the home opener in Montreal, I mean, Gerrard had the shorthanded goal. Marvin set up Pelkey in overtime for the mm-hmm. winner. I mean, you know, at one point Knight went like, you know, 3-4 games without a point. And that's, it's just, you know, listen, in a long season, in a 24 game season, which is both long and short, depending on which way you look at it, you're going to need everybody to step up. But at a certain point, you're going to need consistency from your top players. And I think Boston, you know, at the beginning of the season, that's why they gave Jakes that 3-year contract, expected her to be one of their top players. And when that didn't happen, they kind of needed to adjust, because it's something just, it's almost like the pieces haven't really fit together yet. And they're still mm-hmm. trying to find, like they have all the puzzle pieces in place and they're all really cool pieces, but they haven't been able to put them together in a way. And I think that's a struggle that a lot of teams have kind of had to deal with early on.
Mm-hmm.
But for them, it's glaring because of the expectations, right? Like, you expect that group to be among the best scoring forward groups in the league. And we just haven't seen that yet. And there's still time. I'm not writing Boston off by any stretch of the imagination, but you can see why there is some urgency to make mm-hmm. this trade from their perspective.
Definitely. And I think that Minnesota is, you know, an environment where I think Sophie Jakes can potentially thrive. And I think that she's going to maybe not like start producing at a crazy clip for them, but I think it's going to be just very interesting to see her get into the lineup and see what she can do with, you know, this Minnesota roster that plays with like such speed and such high energy and such, like, I don't know, they are very physical as well. And she's still going to have to deal with like these tough forecheck situations that maybe she's not quite as used to. But I think they're going to be able to free her up to get a lot more open ice than maybe Boston's system was allowing her. And it was interesting earlier when you mentioned Erin Ambrose, because in that Boston-Montreal game, like I kind of saw her do a very similar move to Ambrose's goal, like coming in on the goaltender. Like obviously she didn't have like that great setup, you know, from, you know, Marie-Philippe Poulin and I forget who else this is on that
Murphy.
Goal.
Maureen Murphy.
Yeah, Maureen Murphy. Yeah. And, you know, but she kind of like took it in on her own and she made a very similar move to Ambrose. And I'm like, yeah, like Erin Ambrose is a great blueprint for Sophie Jakes. And it's such a smart, detail oriented, and like instinctive style of playing defense that takes, I think, a long time to grow into. But I think she's more than capable of getting there. It's just, you know, she does need that, the patience and the time to get there.
Yeah. And, you know, it's another parallel to Ambrose is her trade from Toronto to Montreal was kind of probably the closest to a real hockey trade that we saw, because I mean there were a couple of first round picks in that trade that, you know, by the way, were never used because you know, RIP CWHL at that point, but I mean it wasn't just future considerations, there was actual assets given up in that trade. And yeah, I mean, you know, Erin Ambrose, when she first broke into the senior national team, and even the CWHL, was just not the player that she is, or she is now, or that she became. I mean, you know, she was cut from centralization in 2018, and I think that it requires a certain mix of, like you say, instincts, but also confidence to pull that off regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And Minnesota, I think, is a good fit for her, just age wise, because they're a sneaky young team. Like you look at their team and they have, there are lots of names there that we've heard for a while. But even like Zumwinkel and Heisey, like they're first year pros. They have a lot of young players on that team. Someone like Liz Shepherds even, and Claire DeGeorge, and just a bunch of players that have just come out of university. And Jake's kind of fits into that age group, as well. And I think that it's a sneaky young group that they're building in Minnesota, that, you know, you look at their signings of Panic, Stecklein, and Coyne Schofield, and you're like, oh, this is a team that's, you know, veteran heavy, but their drafting did not go in that direction. Their drafting skewed really young. And I think that it's going to be interesting to see how she fits in just with that group altogether. Obviously, a couple of former Ohio State teammates on that team as well. So it'll be very interesting to see how that goes. But yeah, I think it's a trade that is a lot more even than it first appeared. You can't just look at age and draft position. You have to look at the circumstances. And, you know, Boston was not necessarily going to be happy with her taking up one of those high salaried spots, based on what they are. Because, I mean, you look at, you know, free agency is coming up in a few months, and you're going to need that flexibility to kind of surround the players that you have. And obviously there's going to be a draft and as well coming in, and new players that are going to need contracts as well. So yeah, it provides them with flexibility that necessarily they might not have with just the assets and trade alone. There's some whispers that there's a draft pick that's going to be flipped when draft picks are allowed to be flipped. That right now they're not allowed to be traded. There's a couple of people who have floated that out there, but even if not, I think it's a lot more even of a trade than it first appears. Just because Jakes has that name recognition, that expectation. But they got a couple of really good fits as well into that team, and flexibility as well, right? That's a reality we have to talk about in a cap league. It's something that, you know, the salary matters, and we don't know necessarily the salaries, but because she has a 3-year contract, we have an idea of that she's on that high end of that scale, for sure. So definitely going to be interesting to see. And Minnesota coming off of that 4-1 loss to Toronto as well, right? Like we see them at, you know, they've been at the top of the league since the league basically started. Since their first game, they've been at near the top of the league. But there are some games where they show that they might need a little bit of a shakeup. And that 4-1, I don't think it's a coincidence that this trade happened after that last game that they played, which was a big loss to Toronto.
Yeah, it was odd to see their offense kind of like struggle to get anything going. You know, that hasn't been typical of them. I don't, you know, it's definitely probably somewhat reactive, but I think it's more like, oh, like, you know, we're noticing that we kind of, you know, people are starting to get wise to like who our spark plug players are. We need more options. We need to diversify our offense a little bit more. And, you know, that's, I think in, you know, with acquiring Tapani, that's exactly the same thing that Boston did. They really diversify their offense in this way because Tapani can kind of do anything. Like I've seen her kill penalties. I've seen her on the power play, like as a shooting option from the circles. Like, you know, I've seen her do pretty much everything and she can do it well, but she also just has like a great finishing ability. And I think that's going to help them a lot.
Yeah. And Minnesota's strong start, I mean, that came on the back of their goaltending being like insane.
Unbeatable.
Yeah, like .960 save percentage, and Zumwinkel was shooting like 20% or something like that. Like, it's, you know, that was something that people were looking at. Like, I look, it's a great start, but I don't know if they just can keep going the way it's going. And you see it as well. Like, it's I love the Yogi Berra quote. It gets early late. It gets late early. In a 24 game season, it gets late early. You know, we're already almost halfway through the season.
I can't believe it,
which is crazy because it's only like the second month of the season, which is crazy. But yeah, it gets late early in a 24 game season, and you saw the urgency of Toronto, and they're not out of it by any stretch, especially if they keep getting performances like they're getting from their top players. And you know, string a couple of regulation wins together and you're right back into it. Especially if result, because teams, you know, when every game is worth 3 points, there's no artificial, you know, there's no 4-point games, right? Every game is 3 points. So you know that your opponents are going to get 3 points regardless of what results go in. So you're not too worried about an overtime game from your opponents. So it's going to be, this playoff race is going to be insane, because even when Toronto was, you know, the worst team in the league, there was still a big fight for that fifth spot, that fourth spot, in the playoffs. And yeah, it's going to be really, 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 really interesting as we get into crunch time in games 20 and 21, 22.
I think that 4-5 spot is really going to come down to the wire. Yeah. Like I genuinely don't want to know who's definitely in the playoffs until like the last day of the season. Like I think that I may get my wish. Like I just want to be completely like on the edge of my seat wondering what's going to happen.
I don't remember if you remember, I don't think it was the last, it was the before the last CWHL season when Vankey, Toronto and Markham were all fighting for basically two spots, and it came down to like a made up game, like that was postponed and moved to like a random Monday after the season ended between Toronto and Markham. And Markham had to win to get into the playoffs, and they did, and eliminated Vankey, who was in a playoff spot for like the majority of the season. And missed
right,
out.
Yeah, because they had played very well,
right?
And they kind of fell off at the end.
They ran out of steam. Like Elaine Chooley was playing way too much and facing way too many pucks, and just could not keep it going. And Markham ended up making the playoffs like the last game of the season. And It's I don't know if was that might have even been the year that Markham won the Mark Clarkson Cup. I don't know for sure. I don't have that's a long time ago at this point, but that was probably the craziest playoff race that I can remember. And this definitely has feels of that, where it's going to come down to maybe even two teams playing against each other in the last game of the season, or scoreboard watching, or yeah, it's going to be they should do like other sports do and have every game start at the same time on the last day of the season, so you don't know what's going to happen
Yeah, that was the
necessarily.
year that Markham won the Clarkson Cup. They beat Kulin Red Star in
So
overtime.
that so they made it in on the last day of the season. Added Laura Stacey, Jocelyn LaRocque, Laura Fortino. They got all their Olympians back that year.
Yeah, and then
And then
they beat Le Canadien 2-0 in the best of three. Yeah, no, I'm just looking at the bracket right now. Like, yeah, that
and
was a wild year.
game one of that series had the craziest ending to a game that I've ever seen, and it was not recorded. There was no video of it, but Jamie Lee Rattray scored a shorthanded goal in overtime to win
Oh
game
my
one of that
God.
series.
I'm really sorry I missed that.
It was wild, and that was the year that Hillary Knight came to play for the Canadiens at the end of the season as well. So like there was a lot of craziness at the end at the end of that CWHL season that fed into the next year. But yeah, it was wild, wild times. But yeah, I always think of that Rattray shorthanded goal, and I saw it live, and I've never seen it video of it since because it does not exist.
But it's
Which
like
one?
burned into your brain, like a lot
I
of
mean,
Jamie Lee
it was.
Rattray goals are.
I mean, how often do you see a shorthanded goal in overtime in the playoffs, right? Like it's
Yeah.
just wild, wild game, and yeah, I mean, just you. And that was the time when Montreal, I mean, Montreal had Ambrose on that team, and Hillary Knight had joined. They didn't have Poulin at the time, which might explain why they lost in overtime. But
Yeah.
she came the next season. And then that season, yeah, that season was a cursed season where
Yeah, we
nobody
don't need to talk about that year.
just so many injuries that year. I think that full team for the Canadiens played like one and a half games together the entire year. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. We're not here to talk about that. I'll have to write a book about that year. Oh wait.
Yeah, we should really like some of us should get together and like write a book about the CWHL. Like obviously
That
I
last season especially had
Yeah.
so much drama. Like the top three teams in the league all changed coaches in mid-season, which in women's hockey is very rare. Just lots of craziness in that year. Brianne Jenner was stripped of her captaincy at the beginning of that season. Just craziness. Yeah, it's that if it that season deserves a book, definitely. I mean, the
Yeah.
CWHL on its own deserves a book, but that season had it's kind of flown under the radar in terms of just its craziness, and that doesn't even go into the fact that Hillary Knight and Mary Flute Plamb were on the same team for the entire year, which
Yeah.
a lot of people don't even realize at this
Many
point.
people forget this.
Many
Yeah.
people forget this or didn't even know
Yeah.
this. So yeah, it's just
Yeah.
wild, wild, wild year in women's hockey history for sure.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Do we want to briefly talk about I don't even know if there's really that much to talk about, but I'm very excited about the battle on Bay Street on Friday. I'm hopefully going to be there, fingers crossed that like my life doesn't fall apart in the interim. But you know, I would love to be part of like just getting to see like the biggest women's hockey crowd in history would be very exciting. Thing for me personally.
Yeah,
I'm really looking forward to it.
it's gonna be one of those things where it's crazy. Like I did the number crunching today, so Montreal plays Friday in Toronto at Scotiabank Arena, and Sunday in Montreal, Place Belle in Laval. And they're going to have between 28 and 29,000 people at those two games, which will be the two of the three biggest crowds in PWHL history. And Montreal's already played in the top three most attended games in PWHL history. They played obviously the game in Minnesota, the home opener of 13,000. Their game in Laval against Ottawa had 8,600. And then Ottawa's home opener, which against Montreal, mm-hmm. was about 8,300. And so Toronto's going to have 18,000. So that'll go number one. Place Belle on Sunday is very, very close to a sellout. So that's about 10,000 people as well. So Montreal will have played in the five most attended games in the PWHL's history. And they have Pittsburgh coming up, which is probably mm-hmm. going to be in that top five as well. So then you can look at the top six games in PWHL history are all going to be played by with Montreal in it. Obviously, Motor City in Detroit might sneak in there and ruin.
Yeah,
ruin that streak.
I think that's what, like 17,000 in that arena.
Yeah,
in Detroit, 17,000 yeah. something. And it's Pittsburgh's 18,187 because they had to do a Sidney Crosby thing with the seating. So I remember when they were planning that arena out. But my mom and her friends have bought five tickets to the Pittsburgh game. I'm almost definitely going to be at that game as well because my family is from near Pittsburgh, so I can just go crash at my mom's. so I'm also really looking forward to that. Pittsburgh has like been really whole hog into women's hockey at the moment.
You talk about campaigning for a team, like they are like full on, like they're like the team that's like they're like the Salt Lake City of women's hockey, where they're like we want a team and we're gonna do everything we can to get a team and to show that we want a team. Like they're like, I'm sure if they had the choice, they would like literally give Mark Walter the money. Not that he wants it or needs it, but they would absolutely go up to him and be like, we're paying for this team, whether you like it or not. And we're putting a team in Pittsburgh. Like they're single-handedly going to like force expansion. like I think earlier than people expect it. Like I wouldn't be mad about it. And I think that they're positioning themselves to kind of be like, they want a team like October. Like, I just get that feeling that they're just like all in on this. And it's very interesting to see because they're like pushing for it more than teams that like have market teams in their market. Like it's just, and they've also supported it for a while as well.
Yeah. I remember when they hosted, I believe it was the 2017 NWHL All-Star Game. Like they were, they're very invested in it. Like at a time when the profile was much, much lower, which to me shows like a genuine commitment to the sport.
Yeah.
And like for my part, that was probably the best like facilities experience that I'd had up until that point covering like a women's hockey event. Just because like, you know, they were providing the exact same media resources that they would have provided to say, like, I don't know, a Penguins playoff practice, like, you know how playoff practice media availabilities can get. Like it was being executed at a very high level and with a very like intense level of care to make sure that like the players and the press and the fans were all having a really good experience at that facility in Cranberry. So I think they've definitely earned the right to want to support a team for sure. I'm looking forward to that possibility. And yeah, my mom would freak out.
Like there's a lot of teams that have come out of the woodwork more because of the PWHL. But they're like the OGs, one of the OGs of supporting and doing it the right way. Like they held I forget what they called it, but like after the Olympics, they had like that rivalry renewed, or I don't remember what they called it. It wasn't quite rivalry series, wasn't quite, it was kind of
right, but they were like game. Hosting, they were hosting an exhibition. Yeah. I remember that.
Canada US exhibition game and, as well. And they've done PWHPA stuff as well and just definitely always been there. And this is not new. And I think that, you know, if there were seven markets at the start, I think Pittsburgh would have been in that definitely seventh market. And I think that they were maybe a little peeved. And I think they've said that they've been peeved that they weren't included in the six also, the original six.
Yeah.
But they kind of, you know, they Pittsburgh was part of the second six in the NHL. So I think that that's what they're holding on to and be like, okay, fine, we'll be the second group in the PWHL as well. But yeah, looking forward to that as well. I don't have the opportunity to travel, even though Montreal is going to be there, but Montreal is having a watch party actually at the Bell Center, at the restaurant, the Bell Center. They just announced that today.
Really fun.
Yeah, they just announced that today that they're doing that's for the Friday game, not for the Pittsburgh game, but they're probably going to do it for the Pittsburgh game too, now that I think about it. I'm getting my dates all mixed up now. But yeah, they're having a watch party for the Battle of Bay Street on Friday, at the Bell Center restaurant. So it's going to be a lot of fun, and I think that it's I really think that there's a lot of, I don't want to say regret, but like a lot of people are looking at the Bell Center being like, oh, it would have been really nice to have a game there. When now that they're seeing the attendance numbers at other places. And
I was shocked that, you know, we didn't see a game scheduled at the Bell Center, because that was like kind of one of the first things on my mind when they announced this league and they announced the schedules, and I was seeing all these TBD locations, and I'm like, oh, they're gonna do Bell Center, right? They have to do the Bell Center. Like, I've never been to Bell Center, and I would love for my first time there to be for a PWHL game.
Yeah, they'll definitely have one. I think that they, like everyone else, were caught off guard by the support. I think that, you know, they've had games at the Bell Center before, but we're talking about like 5,800 and, you know, crowds that would not even fill up the lower bowl. But I think that at this point, the bar has been raised to a level where I would be surprised they aren't at the Bell Center next season. And that's not inside knowledge. It's just inference. Once they have a clean slate and there's no NHL schedule and there's no concerts booked that far ahead, I think it'll be a lot easier to kind of fit them in. Like even the March 16th, that was a day that I looked and there's no event at the Bell Center that day. But the next day, they start hosting the ISU World Championships, the World Figure Skating Championships.
Right.
So that rink is going to be set up for them, and they have like practices and stuff like that. Like that rink will not be ready for hockey on the 16th. So I don't think that was ever a realistic possibility, just because of that turnaround and things like that. But I would be like, I mean, you had the entire Montreal Canadiens executive show up to the home opener in Verdun. I would be very shocked if there isn't at least one game. Like this year, they're kind of splitting between Verdun and Place Belle. Again, no inside knowledge, just inference and kind of guessing. It would not shock me if next season is split between Bell Center and Place Belle. And I don't think
that would make a lot of sense.
And I don't think that they're going to expect, you know, 21,000 every single game. But I do think that they will want to beat that attendance record that Toronto is going to set. And I think that they can do it. I mean, they're getting 10,000 in Laval, which is a very different demographic. Like Laval is not a destination where people, you know, go from downtown to Laval to, you know, there are some, but it's not a huge influx. It's more people on the north of Montreal that kind of congregate there. But the Bell Center, you can get people from all over to kind of get there. And yeah, I would be very surprised if season two does not include at least one game at the Bell Center. For sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to seeing the game in Toronto. I'm looking forward to seeing the game in Pittsburgh. I will definitely have a little bit of FOMO. But it'll be okay. I'll handle it. And wait my turn for when it comes in my backyard.
Well, you're probably going to get to cover the playoffs. So, and I'm probably not going to have time to do that, because it's going to be a crazy time of year for me. So I'll get to live vicariously through you at that point.
And who knows? I don't, you know, there's not going to be another hockey team in Montreal making the playoffs. So maybe the Bell Center will be available for a playoff game. as well. So again, I'm not this is not like breaking news. This is not like a scoop or report.
I know. It's
half inference and also half wishful thinking on my part. But again, it wouldn't surprise me in the near future. Not in the regular season, but who knows? There's no dates for the playoffs yet. So
I love it when people say mean things about NHL teams. That's all.
Well, I mean, you know, we're used to it in Montreal. the Canadiens have been the best pro hockey team in Montreal for a long time, and they haven't played a game in 6 years. So it's been a long road. Although the Rocket have had some moments, and now PWHL Montreal as well is top of the league as well. So it'll be fun. But yeah, definitely cool that Montreal is part of all these big moments. Although I think that they would just rather settle into a kind of normalcy and not have all these big events. But it's everyone loves, I mean, Montreal's an easy sell, right? When you have the best player in the world, you're going to fill buildings. I think that's just a realistic view of things.
They're just a really fun team to watch. Like, regardless, they're just really fun.
Yeah, it's a fun group to be around.
Speaking of,
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Do we want to talk about the rivalry series we
can,
before we wrap up?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that I know that, like, the rivalry series is kind of funny because, like, a lot of people are looking at this like, oh, is this really necessary at the PWHL? And I think, yes, it is necessary even with the PWHL. But I think that it's really interesting, and I'm curious to your thoughts on this, that 2 years in a row, the U.S. has built up a 3-0 lead and then Canada has won 4 straight. And I'm not saying that in a sense of, like, because it's not a regular series.
I
think it talks more about the dynamics of how these national teams are built, where the U.S. Capitalizes on their NCAA talent available to them and has been unable to necessarily replace those people as we get into the later stages of this. And at the same time, Canada's veterans seem to get better as they play more games. And you see that with Poulin and Spooner especially. I think it's a really interesting dynamic in terms of just how these national teams are built. And I think the PWHL is going to really change the dynamic of that a little bit as well.
Definitely. I mean, not to like do Homerism, like American Homerism, because I hate the United States of America. Like, I live here, I'm from here, but the only time I ever get like remotely, I don't know, patriotic is about USA women's hockey. That's literally the only time. Like, you did lose at the World Championships, so obviously it wasn't everything. But, you know, I do think you're absolutely right about Team USA really not having like different options that they can look to get the same level of offense in particular. I do think that it just kind of speaks to both teams being in a kind of different place, like in their development cycle, so to speak. Like, Team USA has these NCAA level players who are really ready right now to contribute at the national team level, and they're not having any difficulty stepping into that role when the international breaks come around and when they're able to get away from their college teams. Like, they're ready. I think Canada is like the kind of next wave of Team Canada is really like a couple years behind. And I think that that might just be a coincidence, you know, that they're just kind of in different spots right now. You know, there's some players on Team Canada who I would expect to see, you know, formally retiring in the next few years, right? Potentially. And I think that there are going to be players coming in who, you know, might need a little bit of time to adjust and to fill those big shoes. But I think, like, you know, the players that Canada has in like the at the U18 level and you know in NCAA as well, like I think they're going to start getting looks in a more serious way within the next couple of years. And you know it also comes down to strategy. Like you know Gina Kingsbury has really like kind of relied on these older players for such a long time, and there will be a transition period where I think Canada is going to be figuring out how to utilize the younger players. But you know Team USA definitely doesn't have the same like kind of solid veteran core that Canada does, and that's why they're really struggling without their college players, is because a lot of the offense, the energy is coming from those NCAA players.
Yeah, it's really interesting because at first, and I was talking to other people about this, and at first my instinct was, man, Canada's really relying on their older players and they're going to be in trouble. And then I thought about it a little bit more, and you look at their team and you see, and obviously I'm not going to talk about the Sarah Filliers, Claire Thompsons, and Danielle Cerdakny's and players like that who are unavailable to them during this February portion. But you look at players like Emma Maltais and Maggie Connors, and that kind of next wave of player is already developing in the PWHL. And that defense, I mean, look at someone like Ella Shelton, who has really come into her own in the PWHL. I mean, she's scoring every first goal that there is to score in this league, and really developing into an offensive threat that she wasn't at the national team level before this. And someone like Ashton Bell, and that whole generation of like not just graduated NCAA player is something that is going to continue to develop, and Canada can pick from, and even the US can kind of pick from. Like, I was surprised like how little look Maureen Murphy got in the games, because I mean she's someone who has played with great players her entire NCAA career, with Alina Mueller, Chloe Aurard, and then playing with Marie-Philippe Poulin. Like I would almost want to see her play with better players on Team USA and see how that plays, because she's someone who's shown a lot to me. And it's kind of hit the ground running, but not really being utilized like someone like, say, Emma Maltais is on Team Canada, or Maggie Connors. And I think that that's something that's very interesting in the two teams' development cycles, is that US kind of like, they kind of, I don't want to say they panic, but they just kind of take players they know from the U18 level, and not necessarily players that have been performing better at the national team level. And obviously they have camps, like they know these players. I'm not saying that they scout them at 17 years old and then don't look at them again. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that they tend to favor those players that have been on the U18 program, that have been to their fall camps and stuff. And it's going to be interesting to see when kind of the playing field kind of equalizes, where you can be like, hey, this person is putting up more, like all these points, we should probably just take them onto the national team. And you see, you saw Canada kind of do that with Anne-Sophie Bette, but really late. You saw it with Jamie Lee Rattray, who was kind of in and out of that picture as well. And I think that that's going to change the dynamic as well. Like I look at someone that, like I look at the US defense that they brought to the February Rivalry Series, and there's a lot of names that weren't on that team that I think probably were more deserving than players that were chosen, not take anything away from those players. But even just watching the PWHL, that it was interesting, and I wonder if that's gonna change going forward in terms of their player selection. I know it will change, because you get to evaluate these players, and they get to train year round as well, right? It's kind of a catch 22, where you get to see more of them against high competition, and they get to improve because they're playing against high competition as well. So I'm really excited for this next stage of international women's hockey, and kind of looking at it from a PWHL to the national team, and not, hey, look, this national team player is now on the PWHL, but hey, this PWHL player is now on the national team. and that dynamic changing in it. And I think it's gonna be very interesting. But yeah, I mean, you know, look, I'm not gonna say that Canada is dominant at the senior national team level when the US is missing Abby Murphy and Kayla Barnes and KK Harvey, and like, no, like those are you know, Kayla Barnes and Harvey are two of their best defenders, period, and they're just not there anymore. Like it's just
not... I'm comparing the rosters, and even like someone like Rory Gilday, who played on the November roster for Team USA, really impressed me, just like, you know, with puck movement and I think even getting like a little bit of power play quarterback time, like just really impressive at a very young age. Like I think the defense in particular for Team USA really changes dramatically when you're getting these younger NCAA players into the roster. Like they're just generating so much more from, you know, all areas of the ice. Not to take anything away from anybody else, but you know, I almost think like as you get older in that position, sometimes I think players shy away from taking those big risks at times, and like having a few players who are willing to take those risks and who maybe like, you know, are a little bit more impulsive at times, combined with like say a Megan Keller, who, you know, has really been known for so long for her offensive prowess in college, but then like, you know, she's really just become a much more responsible defender as she's aged, and she does these like kind of little subtle things like on breakouts that you might not notice unless you're really paying attention, but she's so smart and like is getting so much better like as she ages at like, you know, covering up for something that might have happened, you know, in another area of the ice. Like she's anticipating so much better. And, you know, just to see the combination of those two styles of play, like younger players taking risks with more responsible veterans, like really changes the whole makeup of Team USA, particularly in transition and on special teams. So I don't know. I think that once we have these college players back in, you know, the world championship roster, things will look different for Team USA. But Canada has also like really kind of come together in a very like interesting, cohesive, exciting way in the last few games of the rivalry series. They were fun to watch. I wasn't enjoying it per se, but they were fun to watch.
Yeah, and it's kind of, you kind of see the parallels to how Team Canada is built and how Toronto is built. And not obviously the people are the same, the people making the decisions, but you kind of see the same kind of things going on. And I think that there is something to be said about, you know, a team kind of getting better as they play more games. And I think that, you know, you're seeing that with Toronto, and you saw that with Team Canada. Like, I don't think that they optimized their roster the right way either. Like that line of Jenner, Poulin, and Turnbull just did not work. It did not work, and they weren't able to kind of, and when you neutralize Poulin's line, which she didn't have a point in the first four games, it kind of they don't really have the depth necessarily to offset that, right? Like you have great lines like the O'Neill, Clark, Stacey line, which Turnbull went on in this leg, and the Toronto line of, you know, Nurse and Spooner and Malte, or, you know, whoever was on that line, definitely were able to produce. But it's only because that Poulin line was also producing and had them to, you know, Spooner was on that line for a bit as well. So it's really interesting to see that even Canada hasn't been able to, even with their veteran heavy roster, they haven't been able to really find that one combination that works, other than like Larocque and Fast on defense and Clark, Stacey, and whatever center they want to put on that line. Other than that, it's kind of like you never know what's going to happen. Like even after they won the first two games in Saskatchewan, they still changed that top line and put Spooner down the lineup and put Rattray on the Poulin line. Like it just seems like they're trying to find that combination still, even despite being a super veteran roster that you should know who that top line is. Like the U.S. does, the U.S. knows who their top line is for the most part, and they try different combinations there as well. But it's never, it's always interesting to see like Canada switch it up a little bit and seeing what they are trying to find in that combination. But it's,
I think, if I'm thinking about who I want to put with Poulin, I would generally, I'd love to see Jesse Aldridge with her more. Like they played really well together in TWHPA. Like, you know, they had this like just really wonderful chemistry where they were like feeding each other and seeing each other so well. And I would love to see Jesse Aldridge get another shot at playing on her right side.
Yeah, there's a lot of players who can play that role. But it just seems like they don't want to, like, I mean, look how long it took Jamie Lee Rattray to get a regular shift on Team Canada. Even despite scoring goals, she would still only play like 4 or 5 minutes a game. But yeah, it's Jesse Aldridge is someone who has really come into her own the last couple of years. And it's going to be very interesting to see. And it was a weird, I would even like even picking like Victoria Bock, who hadn't like played, who played one game before the rivalry series, or maybe two games, but it just weird, interesting decisions. I wouldn't say weird, but interesting decisions, for Team Canada. And it's good for the drama, but there's also some very real dynamics that play to the advantages of both countries, that differentiate November and December and February. And there's very real reasons why. And let's not forget that in November, most of the Canadian players, which again, very veteran heavy, were not playing hockey at that point. And the US's players coming from the NCAA have been playing hockey for like a month and a half as well. So it's, look, I think we're going to see a little bit more of a routine start to show up. But for now, there's very real reasons why the U.S. gets off to a quick lead and Canada comes back strong at the end. And it's not because the U.S. is choking. Like that's not that's the quote unquote narrative. But there's very real reasons why this is happening. And it's not an indication of what's going to happen at Worlds.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll also be at some of Worlds. I feel like I'm really stretching myself crazy thin trying to do all this stuff, but it's also like, I don't want to miss the opportunity to like, you know, to see it for myself. Like that's what's been great about this league happening at this moment is that I've been so truly excited about the sport for the first time in so long. Without like this persistent sense of dread that something terrible is about to happen. So, you know, maybe knock on wood so that I don't jinx us, but it's 2024 has been the wildest possible experience if you follow women's hockey.
Yeah. Women's hockey keeps trying to get me to go to Utica between the preseason event that the PWHL had there and Worlds. I don't think I'll be able to convince the family to go to Utica at Worlds, which is now the second time that Worlds is within driving distance, and I have not gone, and I'm just hoping that one day Hockey Canada will do me a solid and put Worlds in Montreal where I won't have to make the decision. And it'll be made for me. I have that 2026 TBA Canadian destination circled in my head. And like, I'm manifesting that Montreal will be named. But again, no inside information here, just half, no, for Worlds, it's definitely mostly wishful thinking on my part, but yeah, it's nice that it's close. I'm hoping to go. I don't think I will, but definitely we'll be talking about it at some point. Yet another major event that I'll have FOMO at. But hey, at least there's women's hockey to talk about besides the events that I am missing out on.
Yeah, and you know, there's always something to talk about. So we always should do this again in a couple weeks.
Absolutely, Zoe. Thank you so much for joining me and. We have PWHL games coming up. We're Tuesday as we're recording this, so Wednesday there's games and all through the week and back to a regular schedule after a couple of stop and start weeks between the All-Star break and the international break. And it'll be very fun to have games to talk about again and on TV. And it's funny because I was watching Robert's series and like, remember when like this was the only women's hockey that would be on TV, and it'd be like months between when we would be able to see women's hockey on TV. And now it's like, oh, we'll have like, you know, seven games on in the next 2 weeks. Like, it's just incredible world to, time to be in. Like you mentioned earlier, 2024 is wild for people who cover women's hockey or cover women's hockey. Zoe, thank you so much. Thank you all for listening. And we'll see you next time on this yet to be named Women's Hockey Podcast.
Thanks. Bye, everybody.
This episode has been brought to you by Bet Online.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.